Last time on the Active Self Protection Podcast.
I remember just hearing a lot of yelling and saying, what the hell are you doing here? You could tell a difference in the tone of voice too. This is something serious. And this is not a moment where I'm going to just go hide. And as I go to the door, he's already running up the stairs. He's clearly coming after me.
Well, all right, folks, welcome back to the Active Self-Protection Podcast. I am yet again your host, Mike Williver, and you've heard this already, but it bears repeating. I am your favorite former Fed, and back with us is John. His story had so many details that I thought, and I think he would agree, are interesting and useful that we decided to cut this into two parts. I won't be doing this often, so if you have comments for me about how you hate two-part episodes, I mean, type them if you want. But this isn't going to be a regular thing. It's just that John's story is so detailed and there's so much in it that I wanted to make sure we give all the parts of the story the credit and the important significance that they're due. So, John, welcome back. Thank you, sir, for coming back. I appreciate it.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for having me on again.
So people, if you're not sure, if we really hung up the phone and called back another day, yes, we're wearing different shirts. I'm wearing my black comfy shirt. I don't know. John's wearing some sort of polo. So it is a different day. And it's Friday. So we need to get this interview done so I can go eat pizza. All right. So, John, why don't you tell us where we were? I have a rough idea. You had been pretty brutally assaulted, and you're now on the floor of an apartment home that you're not all that familiar with. And all of a sudden, the police show up and kind of walk us through what happened at that point.
Sure. At this time, the police were securing the scene, and the second set of officers came in, and one of the officers saw that I was so badly attacked and had seen this before because he served overseas in Iraq and knew instantly he had to come and protect my head as I was already doing, but he knew that he had to put more pressure on it than I was to help save my life here at this moment. And this is when he slid to me, I realized something was serious, like even more so than before, which is, I think, is very interesting to note now. And he just kept talking to me during this whole entire time and kept, you know, making sure that I was with him and I could somewhat make him out a little bit, but my eyes were pretty bloodshot at this time because I was bleeding pretty, I wouldn't say profusely, but at a steady flow rate from the top of my head.
So let me just reemphasize something you said there. And I don't remember, frankly, if you said this during our last episode or not, but you mentioned this today, at least before we hit the record button. And then just now you said he slid to you. Explain exactly what that means, because I know you told me what it means, but why would he slide to you? What was he doing?
You know, I asked him this actually after this all happened, because I actually met him later on, and he said it was just the fastest reaction that he could do, and he could only think of doing a baseball slide to me. And in the last one, I actually did mention about how I wasn't sure if he was going to run into me the way he was sliding, because I could see something coming at me. And I'm like, what the hell is he doing? What I didn't know is he's trying to make the fastest maneuver to get to me in the fastest time. And if you think about it, a slide can be a nice controlled maneuver, like in baseball and everything, and can help you get there in an efficient time. And
so we're not talking about a janky rookie NFL quarterback slide where they sort of fall over themselves. He practiced this before, maybe former baseball player.
You know, that one I don't honestly know, but it sounds like he's done it before,
right?
You know, based on everything.
Well, we think he's a combat vet, right? That's probably
he was a combat veteran. That's okay. Correct. He served for 6 years.
It makes sense why he would walk in and assess, looking at you, and be like, okay, I know at least a little bit about this, and I know that I need to protect this guy's head. Because at this point, I mean, once your skull's cracked, part of your brain's exposed, the skull's there for a reason. It's the hardest bone in your body for a reason. It's protecting your brain. And once that has been compromised, the slightest bit of pressure, the wrong move, can have very grave consequences. So my question to you is, how did you realize I have this serious injury? Was it just sort of your body just said, cover this up, put your hands here and cover it up? Like, what was going through your head? Were you able to think anything?
Honestly, I mean, in the moment, I just knew I had to protect myself, and I knew that I was bleeding from the top of my head. I know a little bit about medical stuff because both my sisters are nurses. Mm-hmm. And so I hear these stories all the time. And a matter of fact, my one sister was a ICU nurse and a med-surg nurse. So I heard about head injuries a lot from her, you know, hanging around her friends and everything. And so I knew, I'm like, I'm bleeding from the top of my head. I don't know where. I don't know, you know, I knew it was a fast rate, and I knew that in the instinct, and I think about this now, it's amazing that I had all this insight to be able to think that I need to put something on the top of my head, and I had a towel on my head at the time, and then put pressure on it to stop the bleeding, you know. And if I could, like, I mean, you can revert the blood flow too. Like, I mean, I know this all now. I mean, this is all the stuff we know about it. And I sit here and I'm like, yet I knew I didn't want, I shouldn't move either. So like, it's a toss here on what to do. And this time is when, like I said, the officer is there. He's putting pressure on my head. The other officer that was with him split off to go help assist the first two officers that came in to secure the scene. They secured the scene, and then he went into his, you know, top walkie and literally told them that we need EMS here sooner than later. Mm-hmm. What he didn't want to say is that we need them now, like right now, to save this guy's life.
Note to people who show up and stuff like this, whether you're a copper or a paramedic or just a private citizen who has that drive to help other people, this is a great point, and I'm glad you brought it up, because what you don't want to do as the person on scene is be like, oh no, this guy is probably going to die in 38 seconds or whatever. Like, you need to keep it as upbeat as you can and keep the person awake, preferably, especially with a head injury.
Yes.
Don't move them unless you know what you're doing. If you don't know what you're doing, you know that you don't know what you're doing, so don't do anything. And try to find something positive to say. Hey, stay with me. What's your name? Get a name if you can. So was he able to do all that pretty successfully? I'm guessing he was.
Oh, yes. Yeah. He was asking name, keeping me talking, asking, you know, how do you feel? Because he's trying to assess the situation so that he can relay all the information to dispatch, so that can be relayed to, you know, the paramedics, for they know what they're getting into.
Were there any other injuries aside from the head injury?
Oh, yeah. There was, and we didn't get into that in the last part, but I knew we would in this part, is that he continued to take that blunt side and beat me down the side of my back all the way down to, you know, the one side of my leg that I was exposed when I was in the fetal position, and took it all the way down to the heel of my foot.
That's really odd behavior after hitting you in the head. Normally somebody would hit someone in the head and call it a day.
No, I mean, he definitely had a clear motive, like you said in the first part.
No, for sure. Was he, at this point he's hitting you now. So we're kind of backtracking a little bit at the point at which he is.
It was very interesting that he went into this whole mode where he decided that he was going to take me out and beat me and punish me for being there.
Right.
Is a very unique thing, and it goes back to what you said, is this is a premeditated thing.
Right. So for those who are watching, I'm sorry, our feed just went out for a moment early. So in the end result, we might both be talking at the same time, and I apologize for that. I never claimed to be a professional broadcaster. So now fast forward back to when the police here, they show up, and they're this officer is tending to you. He's trying to keep you awake and everything else. If you had to guess, I mean, I'm sure it's not easy to gauge time during something like this, but if you had to guess, how long did it take from them getting there to you actually getting medical attention from an EMT and getting into an ambulance?
It was within minutes. They were able to secure the scene within minutes. The one thing that was in my favor is that the police station was a minute down the street. So the officers were able to get there very, very quickly. They also called in for help backup from the sheriff's department, too. And matter of fact, one of the officers that walked in with the one guy who did the baseball slide was a county sheriff.
Okay.
That was helping him come in, and they were actually securing the scene. Now that I know all this stuff now without from reading all the real police reports, is that they were actually on the corner securing the scene because they didn't know where he was. So they ended up putting out a perimeter, making sure the whole scene was secure. They had EMS on the way when the officers got called first to the scene because the dispatcher knew that they're going to need paramedics right away. Like, we don't know the state and we don't know how they're doing. We just know that, you know, one of them's talking to us right now. And that was my friend was talking to the 911 operator at the time. And they were actually treating her at the time because she was able to walk down the stairs, which is still amazing. You got to remember, she got sliced in the head with the blade side twice. Mm. And she was able to walk back down the stairs after walking up the stairs. And also helping assist me at the time, which is incredible.
Wow.
And when you think about this, I just sat there and I'm like, I'm not moving. But I knew that taking a axe to the head three times, I'm like, this is something pretty serious. And I could cause more harm than damage in this situation. And it was, I should say, after all of this, it's approximately probably about 3 to 4 minutes that they were able to at least secure the scene to get the paramedics in. And I remember at the time as when the paramedics came in, there was, as they kept making me talk and everything, there's probably a good about 10 officers in this little tiny room on top of all the officers securing the scene and everything. Mm-hmm. And I remember, and these are the weirdest things you always remember now, is that I made a comment that I said about their assault rifles. And I'm like, I'm so glad you have your assault rifles with you. And this is all the way across the room from one of the officers that I saw.
Right.
And he saw like the bloodshot eyes and everything. And he's like, how can you see that? He's like, keep talking to me. And he's like, I'm happy to have this, mm-hmm. you know, to have this weapon. But he's like, I can't believe you can see that. That's incredible.
So maybe can you help me understand? Cause I'm not a doctor. I don't know much about trauma medicine other than, you know, plugging up holes and cinching off arteries with tourniquets is about the extent of my knowledge of how this sort of thing works. So when your eyes were bloodshot, did a doctor ever come back and explain to you what that was? Were there blood vessels breaking in your eyeballs, or were you bleeding internally into your eyeballs? Do you know why your eyes
were
doing that?
It was actually the blood coming down my face that causing a lot of that. There was no actual damages to the actual eyes or anything.
Okay. So external.
Yes.
Okay. I got you. That makes sense. So you're able to look across the room and see, hey, this guy's got some sort of, I eschew the term assault rifle because that's what rifles are for. It's kind of redundant. A rifle is obviously meant, an M4 or an AR-15 is meant to stop other human beings from doing bad things, hopefully, ideally, when it's used. You can see that he had a rifle and you're like, I'm glad you have that. How long are you conscious for? Do you remember getting into the ambulance? You remember being on your way to the hospital?
Yes.
Do you remember getting to the hospital?
Oh, yes. Yes. Okay. It was probably one of the most bumpiest rides I've ever had in my life.
And you're aware of every single pebble that the ambulance drives over, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah. So, I mean, like, this is where, you know, the paramedics are coming in. They, you know, lift me up a little bit. They, you know, treat me. And then they start like bandaging my head and everything, and they start getting me ready for transport.
Okay.
Is what they do. And they say, hey, will you be okay? And we're going to have to take you down the stairs. And remember, like I told in part one, there's 19 stairs.
Oh.
You know, that I already have to go down.
I already hate this part of the story. Okay. Were they able to get you down the stairs gingerly? And without too much.
Well, what they ended up doing is they ended up taking those basket type devices that they have, that the fire department has, and they strapped me down in that, and the firemen carried me down.
Okay.
The stairs.
Was it kind of like one of the baskets you might see under a helicopter during a mountain rescue, that kind of thing?
Yeah, similar to that, yes.
Yeah, I could call it, maybe it's called a litter. I don't know. Help me out. Tell me in the comments what it's called. Right. So they get you downstairs. I kind of want to focus on, okay, obviously you had a very bumpy ride to the hospital. And like I said, it's like if you have a sleeping baby in the backseat of your car and you're trying to get them home and not wake them up, the way you drive is a little bit different. And you're suddenly hyper aware of every noise and every bump in the road. You're trying to avoid potholes, going left, going right. They get you to the hospital. You're still conscious at this point, which is impressive. Just kind of walk us through what happened there. And then I do want to get to our bad guy and what ended up happening with him. So do you remember being wheeled into the hospital?
I do. And like you said, we'll back up just a little bit. I remember them in the ambulance, and they were still treating me as I was going. And they told me approximately how long it was going to be. I remember hearing not only the ambulance, but I also had a police escort as well. And this is not like, and this is the stuff I remember. Like, it's still in the police reports. And as I went through the police reports, I'm like, oh, yeah, I do remember
right.
a police escort as well, taking me to the hospital, making sure that I could get there as fast as possible. And I remember being wheeled into the emergency room and going through what I call a painful, I mean, it was not a comfortable ride, but I knew I had to get to the hospital because I knew I'm sitting here. I'm like, if I don't get there, I have no chance of surviving.
So when you say, if I don't get there, are you trying to stay awake? Is that what you're saying? You're trying to not to slip into unconsciousness?
Yeah. They kept talking to me and kept me awake the whole entire time because they knew if I did not keep conscious and everything like that, that it could be even more serious.
So let's go a little bit deeper on that then. You may not remember this. Do you remember, for example, being in the ambulance or getting to the hospital and they're encouraging you to stay awake? They're trying to say, stay with me. You know, what day is it? Who's the president? Whatever. Try to get your brain working.
All of that.
Do you remember, was your brain telling you, night, night, let's go to sleep? Was it like you had to fight it? Was there a sense you wanted to fall asleep or whatever? Or was it just...
I don't think I was that bad at that point. I know that if it didn't get, you know, it could have gotten to that point, I should say.
Okay, but it didn't.
But I was not at that point. I mean, because you got to remember, like we talked about in part one, is that I lost consciousness.
Yeah, I mean, right. So refresh my memory. At what point did you lose consciousness? It was before the police arrived?
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah. It was after the third hit. Is when I lost consciousness.
Right. I do want to make a note also for our listeners. If you ever do want a police escort to feel important, there's two ways. You could become the president or get hit over the head with a blunt side of an axe three times. So those are your options moving forward.
And I don't recommend the axe one. The president one sounds like a lot of fun.
You're not a fan. Okay. Understandable. Of course, you have a lot of bias because you have been struck in the head three times with a blunt object. Yes, so
just a little bit.
you're not a good sample for this poll we're about to take. All right, so let's go back to the hospital. My kids used to call it a hostel. I still struggle with that sometimes, not pronouncing it incorrectly. Hospital. They wheel you in. Are they doing neurological tests right away? Are they asking you, you know, how many fingers am I holding up and all those sort of questions to kind of gauge where your head, literally where your head is at?
You know, they did a couple of those, but like, I mean, the emergency doctor knew right away exactly what happened based on the injuries, what had already been called in, and asked me, do you want to live? And I said, yes, do whatever you have to. And within a minute or so, the doctor pretty much assessed and was on the phone with the neurological team and calling them in and saying, we need an emergency surgery done right away.
Wow. And you're aware of that. You're hearing all this.
Oh, yes.
What's going through your head right now? Because I would be genuinely concerned about dying. It would occur to me that I might be dying shortly if these doctors are saying these words to me.
It started to definitely sink in a lot more when that happened. And The nurses were cleaning me up and trying to, you know, at least get me into a better state and everything. They ended up redoing the dressing because it was already bloodshot from just coming from the scene and everything. And so I remember them cleaning that back up again and redressing my head and everything and actually making it even a little bit tighter. I'm like, okay, this is getting even more serious.
Right.
And this moment is, I should say, when I knew, I'm like, I'm going to have to start probably calling family members too. I'm like, this is just because I'm like, I don't know what's going to happen, you know? And I was like, I'm going to have my sister, you know, come up here, start making medical decisions for me. I'm like, this is real world. Like, this is really happening.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's one of the things we talk about all the time. Stephanie Widener, our CEO, who's also a phenomenal instructor in many different disciplines, likes to say that it's important. And usually she's referring to, you're walking to your car and someone's now approaching you with a knife or with a lead pipe over their head. You know, it's important you radically and rapidly accept reality. You're now accepting the reality that you're in a really bad spot and thinking about things like next of kin and power of attorney and all that sort of thing. I assume at some point, do you remember them saying, okay, now you're going to go to sleep. We're going to put you under for this procedure. Do your memories go that far?
It does.
Okay.
Yeah. There was a couple other things that I do actually remember happening, and the detective actually showed up in the emergency room and started taking pictures of everything.
Mm-hmm.
And I do remember that. And he asked the nurses if we could move me and everything, because he wanted all the documentation of all the bruising and all the hits down the side and everything.
What are the nurses say? I'm curious, because usually they're telling Ellie to go screw themselves. This is our patient. Leave him alone.
At that time, I mean, I was pretty coherent, and they just moved me just a little bit, like just a little bit of shift. And I was able to do some of that myself too. Like, I mean, I was still capable of doing that. And they understood the severity of the scene and understood what was going on. And they allowed it to, I would say, a good degree, and like, they knew that he wasn't going to ask anything that was going to be out of contents or anything that was going to help him
solve
the case, and knew again that they needed this fresh right away so that they could start building a case right away against this guy.
And so then let's fast forward to the trial. We'll get back to this. Was there a trial, or did this guy plead? And if it went to trial, did these pictures come up?
Oh, yes.
Okay. So
yes, all of this was evidence.
Well,
against him.
We'll circle back to that in common parlance now, which people like to say that now these days. We'll circle back to the trial here in a moment. So you're out. They do surgery. How long until you are taking out? Were you put in a coma, or how long until you're conscious again, if you can remember?
I got it into the hospital around 11 o'clock, and I know that from medical reports now. And I went into surgery around between 12:30 and 1 o'clock.
Okay.
And this is, there was medical tests that were done. And of course I had to do an MRI in my head and some other stuff for the doctors before they could do the surgery, so they know what they were dealing with.
Sure.
Between x-rays and MRIs and everything. And the last moment I remember is the doctor came in and literally said, "Hey, I'm going to take good care of you. I've been doing this for a long time." He's like, "We're going to be putting you to sleep here in seconds." And from him. And then about 6 hours later, I wake up in the recovery room with my sister and my brother-in-law waiting there.
That's always nice. I can attest to the fact that a friendly face when you wake up in the hospital makes all the difference in the world.
Yeah, even that, it was a hard phone call to have to tell my sister what was going on. And it was interesting because she actually didn't answer her cell phone because she didn't recognize the number at first. And then when she saw the same number come on her house phone, she's like, okay, something's going on.
Right.
She's like, why is this person calling two numbers of mine? I'm like, obviously they know me.
She's somehow. Like, either John's been hit in the head or my car's extended warranty needs to be addressed at this point.
Right. One of the two. And I think she would have rather had the car extended warranty calling her at 10:30 at night.
So it wouldn't surprise me. They've called, not to get too far afield, but the warranty people have called me as early as 7 a.m. And I'm like, you know, the car is fine. I really appreciate you calling, but I got to get in the shower and go to work.
Right.
So you wake up. When you come out of this, you see your sister and others. Are you immediately remembering what happened and why you are where you are? Do you know what I mean? Because not only have you been out under sedation, but you were hit in the head pretty darn badly, probably as badly as I've ever heard of anyone getting hit in the head and making a recovery like yours. Like, any worse than that, we're not having this conversation. So when you wake up, are you immediately, oh man, I got hit in the head and this happened? Or does it take a while for those memories to kind of come back?
No, it came back within seconds, I would say. I know I was pretty groggy, and my sister says I was still not fully with it. And a matter of fact, I think they probably let my sister in a lot earlier than they probably normally would because of the severity of everything. And the nice part was that when the doctor came out and asked if there was family, and then, you know, the nurse guided him, like, yeah, here's his sister.
Right.
And the doctor just starts talking regular. And then she starts asking all these questions. And he's like, wait, well, hold on. Who are you? And what do you do?
Right.
And how do you know to ask all these medical questions?
Right.
And she said, and he's like, okay. And he's like, all right. And then that changed a lot of the perspective, I think, on how everything was kind of handled. And they're like, okay, yeah, she's a fellow nurse. And so it makes a huge difference. And she knew exactly what needed to be done, like when I was coming to, what was happening. And she even asked, she's like, hey, she's like, I know you don't want to probably talk about this, but do you remember what happened last night? I'm like, yeah, all too well. And she's like, okay. And she left it at that.
Wow.
She's like, yeah. And she's like, what's today? And I'm like, I assume today's Sunday because I went into surgery early Sunday morning.
Yeah.
And she's like, all right.
You're like, let's see. It was like, Saturday night when somebody busted me in the head with an axe. I'm hoping it's Sunday, because if it's Monday, then I missed a whole day. So what day is it? You tell me.
Yeah, please tell me. I haven't been out that long.
So I definitely want to get through your medical. So let's kind of compartmentalize this. We'll finish up with the medical side of things. I'm sure that's a whole story in and of itself, is your recovery. And then I want to talk about your friend and her recovery, and then old boy getting caught in the whole the legal process. Because I think a lot of folks want to know, hey, you know, what potentially is it going to look like if I am the victim of a crime and I have to deal with the legal system? So how many surgeries are we talking? Are there additional surgeries after this first emergency surgery that happened overnight? Or is it just a matter of you lying very still and recovering for a matter of weeks and months?
It was actually amazingly only one surgery.
Wow.
I was very impressed. I do have plates in my head now. That are keeping my brain secure, so that I do have that. It's a little different. It was a little different feeling getting used to that at first, because you could feel them in your head at first as everything was starting to heal and adjust and everything. So there was no additional surgeries. I was actually only in ICU for 3 days. The biggest thing that I had issues with is having grip strength in my left hand.
And that was a neurological problem.
Yeah. And that was due to the side of the injuries that it happened with. And it was interesting because one of the nurses didn't make that connection right away and realized that, like, why are you having problems with and using your right hand for taking your medicine and drinking water with it and everything? And I'm like, I got no strength. And I can't fully feel everything. And I got like maybe 5% strength or 10% strength in there. So I just don't trust it. You know, I've always been strong. I'm a right-handed person anyways. So I instantly went with the right hand until I could get that left hand back.
So go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. Within a couple days started even doing you know, all the therapies they could to get my brain active, to get my body active, everything active again. And then after 3 days, they're like, okay, let's move you to just a general med surge, you know, floor and everything. And I was actually going to be released within 6 days. But they noticed that there was still a little bit of blood on the backside of the brain. And they wanted to see if that would dry and if that wasn't causing any issues, because then I probably would have had to have an additional surgery to evacuate that blood around the brain there. Because for most people, and if for the people who don't know, blood around the brain is not ideal.
No, yeah. You know, it is suboptimal, to say the least. And I can hear the audience clamoring for me to ask this question, so I have to ask it. And again, this is my audience. This is not me. This does not represent active self-protection. The audience wants to know, you were hit over the head several times. You had surgery. They put metal parts into your brain. Do you now have a superpower? And if so, what is it?
You know, I would love to say I have something now. But honestly, I have my life back.
Yeah.
I think what the best way to say it, I don't think you need any superpower to have your life back.
To hearing what you describe, your injuries described to me, it really is astonishing. And I can't get over how we're just having this conversation and I can't detect any problem with your speech or anything. I know it's been a long time. How long does the PT go on for? And are you able to get that left hand up and running again?
Yeah. Actually, I mean, this was the amazing thing is that now, I mean, and kind of review for everybody who's listening, that this has been 11 years, you know, since everything has happened. And like I said, I stayed in the hospital for for the weekend because of that MRI. Mm-hmm. And it was just a safety precaution. Like they were almost ready to let me go. I mean, and this remember, I was, you know, admitted, you know, late Saturday night, and they're talking about releasing me on that next Friday.
Wow.
I mean, it's just incredible. And now, granted, fact, I mean, I had people coming in for, you know, physical therapy, occupational therapy, one to get the strength back in the hand and everything. And I mean, they had me, you know, within, they're like, they wasted no time. And I actually am happy now that they don't waste time. They don't let you sit, you know, and they had me walking around. You know, they had me doing exercises, you name it. I was doing it. And they literally gave me, you know, things to keep the brain active. So they were giving me puzzles and word searches and everything to keep things going so that I always joked, I'm like, oh, is this so I'm not bored in the hospital? But it actually has huge effects on how you recover later on. To be able to do these things.
And remember, the brain is not the heart. The brain, they don't know, I mean, when I say the royal they, medical science still has a lot to learn about the brain. But I think I've heard this somewhere. Also, for older folks who have a family history of Alzheimer's or dementia, that sort of thing can help. Like just keeping your brain active, solving problems and working through things can help your brain and help basically like exercise it like a muscle and evidently have some positive effect if and when you do end up with some sort of, you know, later in life, Alzheimer's brain issue or whatever. Let us go and talk about your friend who was also injured. Could you just give us the bottom line on her? Is she okay? Did she make a full recovery or how was her story different from yours, if at all?
Yeah, sure. So her story, and I thought this was kind of interesting, and is that we were classified as similar, you know, like similar type of injuries, but the severity of mine was a lot worse than hers. And I still like, I mean, I, and I'm, again, this is no medical profession, but she gets sliced with the blade side on the top of her skull.
Right.
I'm like, that's pretty, and twice. So it's pretty severe. But they were able to get her stabilized and get her, you know, into a spot where they could keep her basically in a not critical condition and I went in first for surgery. And you got to remember, this is a small town in Janesville. We were blessed to have that. It was a trauma two, a level two, I should say.
Yeah, that's a big deal.
Surgeon center. And we were blessed to have an amazing brain surgeon who got woken up from his sleep. Actually, I think he was just going to bed, but he was basically, you know, in that state where he's about to go to bed and now has to do two surgeries. And
I'm sure extremely complex surgeries that involve extremely fine motor skills. I hadn't thought about that part, actually. Thank God he hadn't been at somebody's going away party the night before and had three or four cocktails there. It might have been your life.
Right. Oh, I agree. I mean, it was, you know, everything, even as crazy as it was, worked out in a way I can't even explain. And I am blessed and happy for this. And so is she. I mean, she's living a great life down in Florida now. She had, you know, after she had got her surgery and everything, she was able to go home a few days later because her bleeding was stopped a lot earlier. Mm-hmm. And so she was able to go home a few days earlier than me. And I stayed in the hospital again, like I said, just as a precaution near the end, which is still amazing that they were even considering releasing me about 6 days later. And they released her about a day or two earlier than me. So around Thursday, they released her. So about 5 days, she was in the hospital, which is still an incredible thing to think about.
That's truly nuts.
She was only in there.
That's truly nuts. Yeah. The idea that, you know, a week or so in the hospital with a traumatic brain injury. So let's wrap up that part with my last question about that, which is after you're struck in the head and before you know help is on the way or help is there, lying on that floor, we talk about all the time on the main channel. We talk about spiritual fitness, basically meaning you've said all the things to all the people you need to say. You know, there's nobody in your life who there's a big question, Michael. You and your sister hadn't had a giant fight and you called her names and she called you names and you haven't talked in 2 months or whatever. As you're sitting there contemplating the possibility of dying, is there anything like that going through your mind that you had to kind of contend with?
You know, I honestly just wish that, like, I sat there and I'm like, I don't feel like I'm done in my life. You know, I live a life where, and to let the listeners know, where I have no regret. Mm. I have no regret with anything I do. I may have some weird relationships with, you know, like my siblings and everything, but this is one of the things that in that moment, I literally didn't even have a regret of going up there and visiting my friend. I just sat there. I'm like, I still have so much more life to live. I don't want to die.
And at any point, not to get too heavy, at any point, are you walking towards a light? Is there any indication to you consciously or subconsciously that this is it? Or is that never a problem?
No, that was never even a thought. I mean, besides, you know, like I said, I did black out for a little bit, but sure. I mean, that was common, you know, it's going to be common with the injury. And I didn't even think about that. I'm like, I'm not going to even let that happen. If I have the chance to live, I'm going to do whatever I can to survive.
So you get out of the hospital. When you're out of the hospital, I assume the police are keeping somewhat in touch with you. Is this guy in custody already by the time you get out?
Yeah. And a matter of fact, we went into the hospital as I went in as Mr. Smith and she went in as Jane Doe. We went in at mystery names. No one could even know that we were there because he was on the loose.
Right.
And he wasn't caught until Sunday morning time. And this one, and I'll try to make this one brief, but this is something that I know you got your listeners would really like to hear the details about. He sure. actually came back Sunday morning and had the audacity to put sugar down my tank just to make sure that if he didn't finish the job already, that I couldn't go anywhere.
So on top of literally splitting your skull, he messes with your car. All right. So yes. And I want to make a quick point. I assume, do they have anyone posted there for you guys, like a police officer, a security guard or anything at the hospital?
Oh, yes. Yeah. At the hospital, they had cops at both our rooms and they had Security was aware of it, and they made sure that when I went into surgery, there was people standing by as well.
Yeah, for anyone who thinks, oh, well, there's no way he would have gone to the hospital and done that. Yeah, there absolutely is. It's happened before. You know, people will go to a hospital to finish someone off. People especially don't care if they go to jail or live or die. So you get out of the hospital. I think I asked this already, but I'm going to ask it again. Had he been caught by then, by the time you're out and going home, or is he still on the loose?
Yeah, correct. I mean, he was caught the next day after I got out of surgery, and he was retained. Like, I mean, he was put on a $350,000 bond. Like, they were not messing around. They're going to put a heavy bond on him. And they at one point were even talking about making sure that he couldn't even bond out. And they ended up, as the case went on and everything like that, they ended up making sure that he couldn't bond out. So
I'm trying to imagine. I'm trying to imagine that his defense attorney at the bond hearing, like, what do you even say? You know, Your Honor, I've talked to my client, and he promises not to bash anyone else in the head with an axe if we let him go. So, what do you even say? So, I guess the most important question to determine how the rest of this talk is going to go is: does this guy plead guilty to something, and if so, what? And if not, was there a trial?
He pleads not guilty, and he wants to take it to trial because he believes that he can get some of the charges dropped, is basically what his whole play was.
And, like, improper use of an axe, or what charges do you think he's going to get dropped?
You know, or he was hoping that maybe we'd slip up and say something to incriminate ourselves or something. I mean, there was a lot of stuff. And this was one of the points where I was thinking, I'm like, well, I have no money for a lawyer. But the nice thing about this is, because it was such a crazy event, the district attorney took over the trial for our defense.
The DA, the elected DA.
Yes.
Wow, that's a big deal. That's a very big deal.
The DA took over the case and handed it to one of their best defense attorneys. I mean, he was assistant defense attorney, but I mean, he was amazing. I mean, that was, and he led us through the whole entire.
I think you mean prosecutor, process. Prosecuting attorney.
I'm sorry. Yes.
Okay.
Yes,
no, that's fine. I had to double check. So walk us through that process. They come to you at any point and say, hey, he wants to plead. What do you think? Or kind of walk us through what happened.
Yeah, we had multiple phone calls with plea deals, and I sat there and I was like, I just can't let this guy get away with just serving like 20 years or something. Mm-hmm. I'm like, he needs to serve the reputable amount of time for what he did. You know, like that analogy is, you know, like an eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth type thing. I mean, I was thinking that at this time, I'm like, he tried to take my life. He needs to serve a good amount of time in jail.
Honestly, if there was any justice in the world, he would just be sentenced to life in prison. Because,
correct, yeah.
Once you've determined that because you're sad and lonely and butthurt and your ex is with someone new, temporarily or not, that means you're allowed to drop your kids off and try to go murder them both with an axe. Sorry, you forfeited your place in society at that point. Like, we can't let you out and trust you to make any rational adult decisions at this point. You've proven yourself to be dangerous and unpredictable and have terrible decision making. So was there eventually a plea, or did you push it to trial?
Oh, we pushed it to trial.
Okay.
We did not take any of the plea deals. My friend and I, we talked about everything. Attorney, like I said, he was great. And he said, he's like, I just have to present the information to you to say that I did it. And he's like, and it's on recorded, you know, line type thing. So that, again, it's here, but it's your guys' decision. This is your guys' case. He's like, I will do anything you want to, you know, and we'll go whatever route you want. He's like, I understand if you just want it over with and just take the plea, or we'll take it to trial. And
sounds like you had a pretty good DA's office, because a lot of places, they don't even bother to consult with a victim. In cases as serious as this one, they don't bother victim who I don't know. We just need to get this resolved. And yeah, they're more concerned with the efficiency of the flow, the assembly line of cases going through the court than they are about victims and actually any kind of justice. And a trial, a good friend of mine who borrowed this from an attorney that worked for the government, is that a trial isn't so much a quest for truth or justice as it is a carefully scripted word game. And that is 100% true, meaning you get two opposing sides and they get into a courtroom in front of 12 licensed drivers who weren't smart enough to get out of jury duty. And now you have these two sides carefully saying words, you know, to the jury, at each other, trying not to slip up and say the wrong words. I don't know if this is a little bit too much behind the scenes, but this goes to trial. Are you and your friend there? I mean, I know this isn't your hometown. Are you there for the trial every day?
Yes.
And kind of walk us through what happened. We're at 45 minutes, so give us a Reader's Digest version of what happened with the courtroom stuff.
Yes, I understand. We don't want to make this a part three.
Yeah.
I get it. Yeah. So it goes into the trial. The trial lasts for about a week. Mm-hmm. And it was a pretty intense trial. They ended up bringing my friend up who lives in Florida. And her son also came up as well because he actually saw the weapon in the car so that they could go for the, as you said, premeditated. Mm-hmm. Attempted murder is what they were going for. And I remember being there for the beginning for the jury selection and everything. And then they separated us, me and my friend, and we did not hear each other's actual
testimony.
Time when we were on the stand. Mm-hmm. Because they didn't want the jury to make it look like that we were in cahoots and we were keeping the same story. I mean, the story is pretty, I mean, it's hard to not like have the same story on this stuff. I'm like, the story painted itself as everybody's heard.
Yeah.
But during the whole entire trial, they did a very, very good job. They have a very good victim witness program there in that county as well. And they kept us, you know, away from everything. And I mean, we were briefed about everything. And I mean, I was even kept in, like I said, a separate room away from everything. And we were escorted back and forth by officers or bailiffs, you know, so that there was no issues there. You know, like he didn't try anything. I mean, and he was in handcuffs the whole entire time and even had a, it's like a stun gun. It's a, like a taser type thing built in. So if he tried to escape or anything like that, they could instantly press this button and it would tase him. Basically.
Yeah, we have those for our kids. They work great.
Right. Yeah. So, the part I can share that I remember the most is that I actually was called up to, of course, onto the stand, and the lawyer just kept trying to bring up stuff, and he was trying to relate stuff. He's trying to trip me up, trying to get me, you know, having issues and, you know, so that it made it look like my story wasn't relatable or anything. Mm-hmm. And there was one point I even looked at the judge and I'm like, I'm sorry, Your Honor, I don't understand what he's saying. And my lawyer just let this happen because he knew, he's like, I can come right back with this, with the truth, and we can convince a jury this way. He just let the lawyer stumble over stuff and see what happened. He knew that he's like this. I'm like, John's a professional. I'm like, he's been dealing with it, you know, being a pilot, dealing with the FAA and having him being questioned for the rest of his life. You know, he'll be just fine on trial and just let it go and let everything go. And through all the testimonies with the officers, everything, the doctor even, you know, came on. And this is an interesting fact that I learned because I was actually in for the hearing the doctor talk about it. And he literally goes, you know, talks about how if he didn't do the surgery that we would have basically bled out and we would have died. Mm-hmm. And then also said the severity, and each one, my friend and myself, was between 70 to 80 millimeters between being brain dead. And
wow.
So that's, yeah. So talk about like the whole, you know, surreal type thing. And this, that moment I was like, holy cow, I'm even more blessed to be alive than I realize. I'm like millimeters.
One of the lessons
from being brain dead.
One of the lessons I want our viewers and listeners to take out of this, and I think probably, arguably, the most two important lessons are, don't give up. even if you find yourself in a situation where, you know, you're being brutally assaulted and you, you know, you have a serious injury, your mindset is actually extremely important. You know, where your brain takes you while you're waiting for help or getting help is extremely important. And it sounds like to me, like, John, you weren't trying to die that day. The other thing is, I think it's really critical if you are unfortunately entangled in the legal system as a victim of a crime, kind of fasten your seatbelt and expect there to be things that make zero sense to you, why lawyers are doing what lawyers are doing, why they can or cannot bring up the past of the suspect. You know, if he has 1,000 prior arrests for hitting people over the head with axe handles, and you're like, well, shouldn't the jury know that? And the DA is like, no, we can't talk about that or whatever. Just know that there's going to be a lot of weirdness and a lot of bumps in the road with the legal process. And despite how it looks, if you have a good DA, which it sounds like John did in this case, who really cared and wanted actual justice instead of just getting the case disposed and you know, through their courtroom, there's going to be times when you question what's going on, and that's fine. Question away, but know that the legal process doesn't have to make any sense to someone who doesn't have a law degree or isn't knee deep in that world, because frequently it doesn't. And as the victim, you should know that every time you're in that courtroom, whether you're on the stand or you're sitting in wherever, the jury's watching you. You know, they're watching your facial expressions, they're watching your body language. So be aware of that. Because, you know, you could be in the back row of the gallery as the victim, maybe someone next to you makes a joke and you're laughing or whatever. You know, just know the jury is paying attention. They always pay attention to what you're doing and what you're saying. What did this guy end up getting as far as a sentence goes?
He ended up getting sentenced to 120 years in jail. And to give people a kind of an idea for the Wisconsin system is that you have to at least serve half of it before you get parole. And he will be 93 when he gets parole. So they pretty much tailored it to him serving life in jail.
Yeah. Hopefully by the time he's 93, he won't have the strength to pick up an axe handle and hit anybody else with it.
Right. I hope not.
At all. So that's just, I mean, honestly, since you weren't able to defend yourself in that moment when the assault occurred, this is about as happy an ending as one could hope for. The legal system and the medical system both working to get the best maximal good outcome possible, meaning that you and your friend are both alive and lucid and functioning and doing all the stuff you used to do, and the bad guys put away forever. I'm not sure I understand ever charging somebody with attempted murder and getting a lighter sentence. Look, just because you couldn't successfully commit murder is irrelevant. The fact is you were trying to kill someone. I would love to see just plain old murder charges, you know, or attempted murder having the exact same severity in sentencing as murder. If you truly believe that one human being premeditated a murder and killed another human being or attempted to do so, to be treated exactly the same. That's just my two cents. Before we part ways, John, is there anything you want to tack on to the end of this? I don't want to miss anything or leave anything out.
No, I just want to thank everybody for listening to the story. For the people who do like the details, they're for more like the medical side and other things that we couldn't, of course, cover, because I think we could have made this like part 3 or part 4.
Yeah, and part 12 easily of my interview with John. Yeah,
part 12 about this. I mean, because the story for me keeps going on. Sure. And I'm going to plug a little bit here.
Yeah, please do.
I do have my own podcast, Captain Johnny's Podcast. By the time this podcast gets released, I'll be working through my training out in Arizona, and it's kind of like the backstory. And so for the people who keep listening to that, it will catch up to the whole entire thing. And I'll even go in more details, and I'll probably will make that a 3 or 4 part story and continue through the whole entire journey of what's happened, because it's a fascinating thing. And then also the Pilot Network podcast is going to be doing a special medical related thing for all the people, if they're pilots or just curious how people get their medical back after a severe injury like this.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. As well. Yeah. So I'm going to be, so we'll plug that one. Joe's going to be doing a phenomenal job with that one. And we're going to be releasing that one shortly after all of this stuff gets released as well. So it all goes in a moment. But I will say, from my point, living through all of this, you feel like in a lot of these moments that you're really, really weak, but at the same time, you actually come out and see a stronger side of yourself than you never believed. And when you have to fight for your own life, you don't fully realize until that moment how precious life really is. Mm. I think we really do tend to take life for granted too much. And I would let people know that, and I say this even in my own podcast, that if you're having a fight with someone, if you're going through something, you're struggling with something with friends or family, or you just had this, you know, horrible relationship with something and you just don't like it, fix it right away now. Because like you illustrate, like you talked about in this podcast, that you have these moments where everything flashes before your eyes and you wish you could go back. Well, why worry about having to go back when you can just make things right from the start?
Truer words have never been spoken, John. I appreciate that ending. That was absolute gold. We preach it and we mean it. Spiritual fitness is a thing. You don't have to be a Christian, although we, you know, all of us are, and we fly our Jesus flag pretty high around here. Whatever, you know, whatever faith you follow, get right with your God and get right with the people in your life. Because if you're not, the consequences of that can be pretty dire. It can be anything from, thinking about the fight with your significant other at the moment you should be pulling a trigger, you know, or it could be you are about to die. You're definitely about to die. There's no two ways about it. And now there's no more time to say the things you wanted to say. And I pride myself on the fact that everyone in my life knows how I feel about them. Sometimes that's good, sometimes not so good, but they all know. No one's going to, if I were to get hit by a truck today, no one's going to go, I wonder how Mike felt about me, because they'll know. John, once again, I really appreciate you coming on and telling your story. I'm sure that wasn't easy. One more time, the name of the podcast?
My own podcast is Captain Johnny's Podcast. And it is, I will hope to have the website out by the time that this podcast is released. And that is actually CaptainsJohnny'sPodcast.com as well. And then the other one that I will be appearing on is the Pilot Network, or TPN, podcast as well. And so if you guys want to hear more of the background stories and everything, and there's ways to reach, even at the website isn't fully developed yet, and I'm working on it as we speak.
Right.
There is ways to contact me through the website as well, and I love hearing from people, and I love helping people, and I love encouraging people who are struggling and going through any hard time. Because I mean, I went through one of the hardest moments of my life, and I'm never going to be here to judge you, because like it is a different road for everybody, and I give my advice as best as I can, and I try not to be that Monday night quarterback and just give my advice and let people figure everything out in their own life.
John, thanks again.
You're welcome.